This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. James Woods has played his share of tough guys. He was a cop killer in the Onion Field, a fearless and sometimes foolish journalist in Salvador, and a gangster in Once Upon a Time in America. He specializes in roles that are high-intensity, full-octane portrayals. In the films Casino or Videodrome or Any Given Sunday, it's hard to take your eyes off him. He's had a long and respected film career, but Woods made his first big impact on television as a concentration camp victim in the miniseries Holocaust. And he's returned to TV lately, making just as big an impact. He played a dying patient on ER and an exaggeratedly manic version of himself on Entourage. And as of this week, he stars in his first weekly series, playing a ruthless defense attorney-turned-prosecutor in the CBS drama Shark.
You want to win? Grab a pencil. I live by three simple rules. My cutthroat manifesto. These rules guide every single decision I make on every single case. Rule number one, trial is war, second place is death. Rule number two, truth is relative. Pick one that works. Rule number three, in a jury trial, there are only 12 opinions that matter. And, Ms. Troy, yours, most decidedly, is not one of them. Now, from this day forward...
In Shark, James Woods plays a variation on a familiar theme. Once again, he goes with his strength, playing a cocky, self-confident, charismatic snake. When Terry interviewed James Woods in 1999, he told her he was fascinated by the behavior of extremely charming people.
I have found in my rather voracious reading about many criminal types, whether they be in politics or in the world of petty crime, that oftentimes very charming people are in fact highly sociopathic. I mean, they use charm as a kind of negotiating ploy to lure people into their lives and into their circles and then kind of vampirize them for their own ends. And, I mean, we see it from the highest level of politics to the lowest level of street crime where, very charming people find a way to enlist compatriots in their worlds of crime.
You mentioned that you've done a lot of reading about sociopaths. Is that because you've played so many of them?
Well, in the process of playing them, but also, I mean, in the news, I'm always fascinated by those kind of offbeat stories. I mean, whether it's, politicians who pretend to care about a certain group of people, but then in fact sell them out, but keep smiling and using them as a political base, you know, to enhance their well-being and their positions of power, or the odd news item. I remember I was in Hawaii once. And there was a front page article when I was, in Oahu, and a guy who was a crisis manager at an anger institute. It was an institute for the management of anger. Had beaten the crap out of one of his clients, at some point. He just got fed up with the guy and beat him almost to death and ended up, putting the guy in the hospital and he went to jail. And I just love the idea of an anger crisis management, guru beating up one of his clients. I mean, that kind of thing always fascinates me as an actor because I believe that people have by and large, you find that people are, engaged in chronic manic denial over who they really are. So they're always rationalizing or defending a position that, in fact, is usually the opposite of how they truly behave behind closed doors or in moments of when they don't feel they're being observed.
I'd like to talk with you a little bit about the role that I think of as your breakthrough role in movies. And this was in the film The Onion Field, where you played
right. A
sociopathic killer. Your character, Greg Powell, was a small-time thief who thought of himself as a brilliant master criminal, and he and his nervous partner ended up abducting two cops and killing one of them after
right. They
stopped these two guys on the road. I want to play a clip from The Onion Field. In this scene, your character Greg and his partner Jimmy are on a robbery spree. They're laying over at a motel, and after your character Greg has had very noisy sex with his girlfriend in the motel, he comes out to the parking lot to talk to his partner Jimmy.
We're going back to L.A.
L.A.? Jumping Jesus. One night in Las Vegas, one night in Bakersfield.
Jimmy. Now, Jimmy, we're doing okay. We bought us this cherry little hot rod, didn't we? We bought us some nice presents. And we had us some fun, didn't we?
Fun? Like I got to lose 10 nickels in the damn slot machine. Greg, the last thing you said, we was going to Frisco. L.A. is a two-hour drive in the wrong direction. We moving around like damn gypsies.
Jimbo, you just don't understand. We are going to Frisco. But first, we got to go to L.A. and get us some money by pulling another little job there so we can go to Frisco. You understand? Now, we're just going to leave the wagon here, and we'll be back by midnight. Okay? Now, what you got to do is remind me to get the brake lights fixed on that coupe, because we can't get stopped by the cops for faulty brake lights. Now, can we, huh? So me and my little honey bun got you stirred up there, did we? You know, I'm kind of a virtuoso sexually. That means that I'm a master at pleasing women.
She says that she can never imagine herself with another man ever again. How about that?
James Woods, what did you do to get a sense of this guy, of his ego, his confidence, and his lack of conscience?
But, by the way, one of the ironies of that scene, for people who haven't seen the movie in quite a while, is that the character I'm talking to, the Franklin Seals played, Jimmy Lee Smith, had just had sex with Greg's girlfriend in the scene before, and I'm telling him about what a sexual maestro I am and so on, and how she could never imagine herself with another guy. And, of course, an hour before, he has, of course, been with her. And it's one of the ironies of the scene about this guy's, you know, he's such a blowhard and, of course, you know, doesn't know anything about what's really going on. That character was fascinating to me because he actually would put on a fake Southern accent, and it was hard to do because, as you notice, it sounds kind of weird. It's not really a very good Southern accent, but he actually talked that way. He tried to be always something other than he was. And the irony, of course, from that scene is that they were stopped for having a faulty taillight, and that's when they killed Ian Campbell, the police officer, and kidnapped Carl Hettinger. And it ended up in the longest set of trials in the history of California jurisprudence, you know, trying to convict these guys. I think the resources of Joe Wambaugh's brilliant book, The Onion Field, which was, as he said, the thing that he felt he was put on earth to do, to write that novel. It's a Romana Clef. I mean, it's written as a true story, and it is a true story. Was so rich, and it showed so much about this guy's insane charm. And the great thing about true stories is invariably there are things that take place in those stories that you cannot imagine in real life. I mean, from the smallest detail, and we researched the film meticulously, there was a very funny scene in the picture where I turned to Jimmy Lee Smith, to the Jimmy Lee Smith character, and I go, "So, you know, Jimmy, how do you like my disguise?" And he says, "Greg, what disguise?" I go, "Well, look, I darken my eyebrows and I put this little mole on my earlobe, see?" And of course, you know, it's like he darkened his eyebrows and put a mole on his earlobe. Well, the irony was when Carl Hettinger later described the assailants, he said, you know, one was, you know, a black guy, you know, 5'10" or whatever, and the other was a white guy with a mole on his ear.
A lot of people say that when you're playing a bad guy, as the actor, you're not supposed to focus on what's bad about him. You're supposed to get into the guy's way of thinking, into his own self-delusions, and think about why this guy has such confidence, why he thinks he's right. Were you able to do that for this cop killer when you played him?
Well, I mean, it's a tough one because you're playing a cop killer, but I could. What I try to focus on is the fact that most killers, you know, I mean, sometimes actors, when they're not really doing their work or if they don't maybe really have the, I know, that extra sort of indefinable thing it takes to portray a character in a unique way, you know, say, "Oh, I'm playing a killer," so they're snarling around and so on. Well, killers aren't killing every minute of the day, you know. I mean, what they, you know, they still have to go buy groceries and get their laundry done. And, you know, I always try to think of, you know, giving a character like that a life, I mean, an entire life, the way he would think about all the everyday boring details of living his life. And then along the way, just unexpectedly, this capacity to destroy in such a horrific way just erupts. And I think that's the way it is with most sociopaths, you know. Their approach to life is, whatever's good for me is what I'll do, and whatever I need other people to do for me, I will charm them into it. You have to think about the objectives or the goals that people have in mind. You know, there's theories of acting where you talk about having a through line to a character and a super objective and then momentary objectives throughout the beats of each scene. And the super objective of any sociopath is, how do I get everything I want all the time and pretend to be a normal citizen when I have to get other people to do it for me?
So did you, when you started playing roles like this, did you have enough... did you have any sense of, like, big self-confidence or swagger in your own life that you could draw on, or were you just, like, studying other kinds of characters?
I tell you, that's a good question. I think when you're young, and maybe when you're young and, in particular, male, there's a kind of just sort of, you know, there's a greater level of what I now see as a kind of manic self-confidence that comes as a way of sort of denying your fears. You know, a lot of male behavior, you know, extreme sports, you know, war, you know, a lot of aggression that comes naturally just from biological, you know, imprint, you know, of young males has to do with a kind of confidence that as you get a little older and wiser, you realize is a pretty false confidence. But confidence doesn't know whether it's true or false. You know, you just go out there and you feel it until you get that first big whack on the head with a 2x4 from life. And then you go, oh, I get it.
When you were a young actor, did you use your self-confidence and swagger to talk yourself into roles?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I used to, well, actually, I still do that. I don't think I've ever been sort of right for any role I ever played in the eyes of the people who are hiring me. I mean, it's so funny. I mean, to this day, I always get, oh, he's a great actor, but he's not right for the part, as if these geniuses who make the crap that you see in the theaters every week of your life, as if they would know what was right. You know what I mean? It's just unbelievable, you know. Yeah. Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. You're so brilliant. You just made, you know. And then you look, you know, you open the paper. You know, I always say to people, they go, well, you know, you should pick, you know, maybe a better role or something. I go, really? Name 5 good movies you saw last year.
Yeah.
5
yeah.
good movies. Not 5 great ones. 5 good movies. Nobody can do it. Nobody can name you 5 movies. They make 10,000 movies a year, and you can't name 5 that are any good.
What's the most extreme thing you've done to get a role that you really wanted?
Well, The Onion Field, actually, speaking of The Onion Field, they had already chosen another man to play the part. And they said I wasn't right because I didn't have blue eyes and blonde hair because, you know, they never heard of makeup. But I insisted that I could play the part better and blah, 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 blah. And I finally went and I said, look, I want a screen test. That's the least you can do. And I knew that Joe Wambaugh was supposed to be a very fair guy. I said, in fairness, you should give me a screen test. And he said, look, the reality is we can't afford screen tests. So together, my agent and I, like, sold a car and put the money together, and they did a screen test. And the screen test was going to last all day. And they put the camera on me first, and I did one scene, one monologue from the movie, and I knew that I'd nailed it through the roof like with a nail gun. And I finished a take. He said, okay, now next. I said, we're not doing anything next. If you can't tell by now, you'll never know. Goodbye. Good luck with your film. And I walked out knowing that they'd go, you know, because I knew that that move, more than the screen test, was going to convince Joe Wambaugh that this is a tough guy. And it was a tough move because I had a lot on the line. I mean, I was doing what every gambler does, which is, you know what? I got an 18. The dealer has a 10. Give me a hit. Give me a card. Give me the 3. I know it's coming, you know? And that's what we did.
Did you have that planned in advance? Did you know you were going to make that move?
No, actually, I didn't. It was a kind of spontaneous seat-of-the-pants move. You know, like all great moves in life, you know, you just sort of get a wild hair up your, you know, and you just say, you know what? I'm going for it. I'm just going to go for it. I'm just right now, right at this moment, you know, it's like, you know, with a woman that you fall in love with on first sight, and you just say to her, you know what? Instead of doing all that liberal, you know, fruity crap that, the sensitive man is supposed to do, instead of saying, you know, maybe we should go out to dinner and, you know, I should listen to your problem. You say, I tell you what, how about you and I jump on a plane, go to Paris, get married, and let's go from there. What do you think? You know? And, you know, I don't know. Sometimes it works.
And other times it doesn't.
Yeah, but, you know, that's only alimony.
I want to ask you about your 1984 movie, Once Upon a Time in America, directed by Sergio Leone.
Right.
And this is a kind of gangster epic in which, epic in terms of the way it's shot and the amount of time that it spans and everything, the story that it tells. It's a gangster film starring you and Robert De Niro, and it traces your friendship and your rise and fall. It begins in the early 1900s. I want to play a short scene with you and Robert De Niro in a car. Here we go.
How come you didn't tell me?
Being inside can change it. I'd already made the deal with Frankie to get rid of Joe. With a man like Frankie Minaldi, you don't say yes and then say no. I cannot take the chance to change your mind. Do you understand?
Well, you were right. I would have said no.
Frankie Minaldi is as big as they come. He's got the combination in the palm of his hand.
If we're not careful, he's going to have us in the palm of his hand.
You don't get nowhere alone.
I thought you were the guy that said you didn't like bosses. It sounded like a good idea then. It still is.
Let's just think about it, Noodles. They're going to ask us to come in with them. There's a lot in it for us.
Today they ask us to get rid of Joe. Tomorrow they ask me to get rid of you. Is that okay with you? Because it's not okay with me.
James Woods, I'm wondering what it was like for you to work with Robert De Niro because you seem like such different kinds of actors. Rightly or wrongly, I think of you as a very extroverted person and actor, and I think of De Niro as probably a very introverted person. You're so verbal. He seems so nonverbal off camera, you know, off
right.
screen.
Right. Well, actually, Bobby's, that was one of the great experiences of my life because he is, I think, one of the greatest actors in the history of cinema. And he is a wonderful guy personally, very devoted to the work and to his friends, a very loyal man. And we became friends and have been friends ever since. And he's a very, very intelligent guy, very perceptive about the work and about life and very sensitive man. And a lot of people think of him as very kind of introverted. His basic nature, that of a compressed somewhat withdrawn person, or having that aura as an actor, worked very well for his character, and the more expansive nature that I sort of seem to have on screen, and I'll take your word for it, worked great for the character I played, and they were supposed to be that way. One was very introverted, and one was very extroverted, and it was kind of on-the-nose casting in that sense.
Did you have a different process for getting in character?
Well, we actually didn't. Believe it or not, Bob is one of those people who has a barometer for the truth of a scene. I mean, he just can't act if the scene isn't right. He just isn't able. He just sort of says, well, this feels false. He just doesn't know how to do it. And if the scene is right in the way it's kind of set up and conceived and written and the acting is going pretty well in rehearsals, he just flourishes. He's a natural. And it's not like he puts his foot down or something. He's just not very good at doing he just isn't capable of doing bad acting. He's just not capable of it. And he's just a natural when everything's right. And I have sort of the same instincts. I mean, I have a hard time saying sort of stupidly written lines. You know, I mean, one of the funniest things when you're an actor is people always come up to you and go, how do you remember all those lines? And, of course, the oddest thing about being an actor is that's the easiest part. And it's really easy if a scene is really beautifully written. I mean, you can almost have a photographic memory. And if you have trouble remembering a scene, it's probably because it's badly written. I mean, you know, bad writing is hard to remember. I mean, I'm always, like, amazed when waiters come up and they give you a list of the specials for the evening. I go, how do you remember that crap? You know, the beet juice, squid ink, pasta. I mean, I couldn't remember it to save my life, but yeah. I can remember, you know, 10 pages of Shakespeare, you know, in the time it takes me to read it because it's so beautifully written and it makes sense and it's logical and it follows, you know. I mean, the great thing about great writing is usually what you say next after a character has spoken is what really at its apex, you know, is what your character would say in that situation, you know. And if it's great writing like David Mamet or people like that, you know, it's what the person would say but in a tremendously eloquent, you know, inventive way.
Jim Swartz, what were you like in high school? What do you think people knew you for?
Well, I was voted three things in high school. I was voted most likely to succeed, wittiest, and class clown. So I was like the guy who they thought was going to do really well, but also was like always, you know, like flinging pennies at Mrs. O'Leary in study hall and stuff, you know. So I was sort of a prankster, but at the same time, you know, like sort of the smartest kid in school, but instead of being a geek, I was kind of like a prankster. So, I had a ball in high school. I just had a lot of great friends, and we had a school that actually was a very, I had like 26 kids in this little class I was in. We had a big senior class, but there was a small group of us called the academically talented, you know, it was like the smart kids or something. And they were actually pretty cool, but like my class of 26, I mean, we all went to, you know, to Harvard, Yale, MIT, Dartmouth, Brandeis, you know, Georgetown. I mean, it was a pretty smart, wonderful group of kids who, you know, were of that baby boom generation where, you know, having a great education was a real premium that we all aspired to.
Now, I'd always heard you had these, like, incredible IQ and SAT scores, and right. I read last night that when high school, I think you got like 180 IQ and a perfect 800 score in the verbal part of the SATs. And was there pressure on you to do whiz kid kind of things with scores like that as opposed to acting?
Yeah, there was. But luckily, because I was in a class of kids who, you know, were all national merit finalists and, you know, others had 800s on their college boards in this little class of mine, I sort of took for granted that there were a lot of other people out there with a lot of talent. And, you know, the only thing that was going to get you across the finish line, given the fact that we were truly blessed by God with his intellect, was going to be some hard work. And when I got to my freshman year at MIT, I mean, the average, I mean, there were 900 kids in my freshman class and over 400 of them had 800s on their college boards. So you say, oh, I get it. You know, it's that shocking thing that happens to every high school debutante when she goes to Hollywood and realizes that she ain't the prettiest girl in town anymore. She's one of 100,000 who have the same aspiration for the same three parts, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, going to the big city is a great leveler for all of us. And, you know, my life has been a constant journey down the road to humility. And believe me, the one thing I have learned that is my greatest asset is I have finally ultimately learned to be humble. And it's fine to be cocky when you're young. You know, when you're young, you're supposed to be cocky and a Democrat. You know, when you're older, you're supposed to be a little wiser and a Republican, I guess. Joke.
Well, James, it was a pleasure to talk with you. I want to thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
James Woods speaking with Terry Gross in 1999. His new TV series, a legal drama called Shark, appears Thursday nights on CBS. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.